All right, so I'll just start it off with some questions related to the State of the City address. One of the main points of the mayor's State of the City speech was that the city wants 1% of the provincial sales tax to bring down our infrastructure deficit. Is this a reasonable request? This is the question I'm putting to the panel. And can the mayor realistically ask for that without raising property taxes? We'll start with Christopher Leo.
I do think it is a reasonable request. The theoretical argument that's made in support of that request is that cities are at the center of the growth and development of our economy, and yet property taxes are not a revenue source that necessarily grows with the economy. And so the idea is that a sales tax does grow with the economy, so that's given as one of the alternatives that would allow the city to take better care of its infrastructure. And I think that's the other more less theoretical and more concrete point that certainly commends itself to me, and that is that it's clear that infrastructure is deteriorating across North America. Hardly anything is more important, or very few things are more important to our economy than the health of urban infrastructure. And it's clear, too, that cities across the continent are not maintaining their infrastructure properly. And Winnipeg is Exhibit A in that regard. It's the poster child for deteriorating infrastructure. It seems obvious to me that we need more resources if we're going to take proper care of them. I would say, though, too, before the federal or provincial governments give money to the city of Winnipeg for infrastructure, I would strongly recommend that they tie the money, that they place conditions on it, because past experience has been that if you give the city of Winnipeg some infrastructure money, they're going to build more roads, worsen the sprawl problem, and then they'll be back asking for more money for infrastructure. I think I'll leave it there for now.
Brian Kelsey?
Sure. Thanks, Ethan. And the question is it a reasonable request to look for a point of PSD? I think it's reasonable. The problem is that City Hall has never reasonably asked for the point of PST, and let me explain that it's important to ask reasonably, because if you're a city official who's far-sighted enough to look at this from the perspective of the provincial government, to some of the points that Chris touched on, let's say a point of PST is transferred tomorrow. The province has no guarantees that that'll be the end of the requests, so they may be 1 year later facing City Hall saying, well, we haven't solved our problems, you need to give us more cash. They have no guarantee that the funds will be used for the purpose for which it's being lobbied for, which is infrastructure spending. They have no guarantee that the funds won't be used either directly or indirectly to subsidize additional business tax cuts or additional property tax restraint. And remember that although this wasn't the case a year or two ago, the provincial government that's being asked for this funding has problems of its own, whether you're looking at tax revenues or potential cuts to transfer payments or deficit issues or whatever. So my perspective on this is that I think it's time for the city to get a deal like this. Income taxes are more progressive than sales taxes, but sales taxes are definitely more progressive than property taxes. That being said, that City Hall needs to learn how to ask properly and politely. Right now, City Hall's negotiating tactics for more money with or from the province, and this isn't much different between Sam and Glenn in their respective forms, is to put a gun to the province's head and say, give us the money. And the missing piece has been, what's in it for the province? Not just politically, but what's in it in terms of the policy objectives that will actually formally and legally be delivered as a result of those transfers.
Thanks, Brian, and thanks everyone else for coming out tonight. Yeah, I'll chime in as well. It is a perfectly reasonable request. You know, as Professor Leo said, you know, that politically the city is a creature of the province. I mean, all municipalities in this province are. But really, I mean, the province kind of derives its existence from the city. I mean, it historically has. You know, it only came about because development was happening at the Forks, and now 2/3 of the province lives in the city. So I think that cities should have more, you know, taxation power, but you know, that brings us to the second part of this question, which was, can the mayor realistically ask for this without raising his you know, his own property taxes, and it's kind of like, well, not really, because it's kind of like, you know, we've tried nothing and nothing's working. You know, if you need the money so bad, maybe you should, you know, raise your property taxes a bit.
As a quick comment, we were talking earlier, and I think one of the problems with this discussion is going to be that the three of us on this panel actually agree on an astounding number of issues, despite our different ideological histories and bents and so forth, which tells you a lot about how bad things are at the city, that we can all agree on what the problem is, and the solutions are so obvious that three completely different people can agree on them. That being said, I want to say that I think the root of a future deal is actually on property tax, in the sense that if the mayor and council was organized enough to go to the province and say, look, you've got rising property taxes still on the school board side, we've created an unlikely and accidental competitive advantage from having low property taxes, we'll guarantee we'll keep property taxes at a certain level in exchange for PST funding that solves these other problems. I think that's where you start to construct the kind of arrangement, the two-sided arrangement that I'm talking about. But for that to happen, you actually have to have a financial plan that goes beyond a 1 or 2 year window. And I was the mayor's budget advisor, and I can tell you as an outsider, and I could have told you as an insider, that at most city halls, public servants are trying desperately to plan on more than a 1 year cycle. Right now, council, the mayor, and executive policy committee, the mayor's cabinet, is planning on a, you know, 2-3 week, 4 week cycle politically in terms of where expenses are going. So they really need to actually have a plan before they can convince the province to sign on for and fund that plan.
The mayor touts the benefits of the property tax freeze, but he has a hard time, I think, articulating what that benefit actually is, or at least he hasn't convinced me entirely. So do you think that the property tax freeze has been beneficial to the city? If so, how?
Whose turn is it to start?
We'll start with Brian Kelsey.
Okay. That way everyone can rebut whatever crazy things I say. But, Ethan, I think it's important to understand, you know, looking back at the history, it's now been 13 years worth of property tax freezes. I think that property tax freezes started in Winnipeg not as an intended benefit for development or business. The problem was that in a low-wage city where wages weren't rising, you had people, in many cases from left and right, arguing that property taxes were increasing and income taxes were increasing and other forms of taxation were increasing faster than Manitobans and Winnipeggers' wages were increasing. And there wasn't really an end to that. And so Winnipeg was one of the most property taxed jurisdictions in the country at that point. As a result of the freezes, despite all the skepticism out there that the freezes were actually happening, Winnipeg is now almost at the bottom of the property tax scale municipally. School taxes distort that, but it's actually a remarkable achievement. So remarkable, I think it probably should have ended a year or two ago, because the costs of maintaining that low tax rate are starting to exceed the benefits. What's the benefit? The benefit is that ordinary residents aren't paying too much and can live here comfortably. There could be a competitive benefit in terms of sending a signal that we're an efficient city if somebody was promoting that benefit. But I want to be clear that one of the strange things about the property tax freeze that speaks to, you know, the inertia at City Hall is the number of people, you know, I have two other hometowns besides Winnipeg. I worked in Toronto for years, and the number of people outside of Winnipeg who know there's been a property tax freeze in the investment community, the business community, the municipal finance community, you could probably count them on, you know, it's probably a few dozen across the country who are actually aware of that. So if we were promoting this as a competitive benefit, we certainly aren't taking any advantage of it. So that should force you to wonder whether this is part of a strategy or whether it's just, you know, something we're clinging on to, and I think it's something we're clinging on to at this point.
And I mean, you know, that the rates of taxation haven't increased, but I mean, for many homeowners, their taxes are increasing because the value of their property is increasing, and so you are seeing that argument that the mayor makes, that, you know, this is to protect poor old homeowners, you know, from getting swamped by property taxes, doesn't hold much for a lot of neighborhoods in the city where they've seen, you know, 50, 70, 80% increases over, you know, the course of the last 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, for those people, their taxes are going up, even if the you know, the tax rate is not increasing. And I mean, yeah, and it isn't, you know, as Brian said, it's not out of, trying to create an economic advantage here, like we have low taxes, come do business here. It's, it is just kind of a, an election kind of thing, like just to, keep the average voter happy. Yeah. Professor.
Yeah. Well, if my recollection serves, we had the highest residential property, when this freeze started, we had the highest residential property taxes in the country, but not the highest business taxes. I would agree that if you're in the position of being the highest tax jurisdiction, you have to try to bring your taxes in line with other jurisdictions. You can't simply go on taxing your people at a much higher rate than other places are taxing them. But we've long since passed that point. We're now into this bizarre game of fiscal chicken where nobody wants to be the first one to end the tax freeze, and it has become really bizarre. As for the question of whether what kind of a competitive advantage for the city as a whole comes from lower taxes in terms of attracting business and things like that, I'm not an expert in this area, but certainly from what I do know, businesses take a lot of things into consideration. Besides, they take a whole range of different things into consideration when they decide where to locate. And I'm not really sure that you could point to a literature that clearly demonstrates that cutting the property tax is going to bring you big advantages in terms of attracting business, although that might be the case if there are particular kinds of businesses you're targeting.
In terms of what do you think the city should do going forward, I guess, on the level of finances or on the level of the property tax freeze? What kind of percentage of increase would you like to see, if any at all?
Who's first?
Professor, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think we should start. I think that the city needs to start raising its property tax. And I think Brian pointed this out. If he didn't, I will. That would be one of the things that he could use as an argument in support of getting another source of taxation. I don't have a particular figure in mind as to how much they should raise it, but I think we need to start raising it. It's just simply unacceptable to have our infrastructure deteriorating at the rate that it is, and still not try to get the revenue that's needed to start to fix the problem. But I would also like to put in, and I noticed neither of the other panelists responded to one of the points I made, which is that if you give infrastructure to the city of Winnipeg, they're going to use it to make the sprawl problem worse. And I'd be curious, I didn't hear a response from the other panelists on that point. I'd be curious to hear what their position on that is, or obviously it's up to them. But if they would like to respond to that, I think that might be an interesting point to discuss.
Shall I? With respect to what to do going forward, I want to make it clear that the vogue answer, and this was certainly Judy Washer-Lisa's answer as a candidate for mayor, is to say, well, let's look at inflation. Inflation is an arbitrary number. The reason why this is a problem, not just from a competitive and a tax standpoint, but from a city management standpoint, is that there are at least three independent cost pressures on the city right now, each of which is outpacing inflation in an average bank of 4 years and so forth. There's cost pressure from salaries, many of which are for unions like the police, fire, and paramedic side, where they are effectively out of the city's control because all three unions have the right to go to arbitration, and arbitrators typically pick a number for salary increases that's over inflation. Second, you have construction inflation driving costs. And third, you have over the last couple of years, whether it's Skyhawk 1 or Air 1 or whatever it is, or different promises coming out of the mayor's office and city council and whatnot, you don't have nearly as much restraint on discretionary spending as you used to, that we're always adding a million here and a million there. Those three different bars alone are outpacing inflation. Personally, the mark I'd like to set, or see city council set, is to say we're in the bottom 20% or whatever it is of property tax cities right now in Canada. And I'd like to see them commit to stay within that bar. And so there at least we've got something to say, well, we got something competitive that we can brag about out of this whole exercise and stay within that band. But at the same time, since other cities are increasing property tax at rates far exceeding inflation, frankly, if you look at most cities across the country right now, that still gives us some wiggle room in an emergency to actually try and deal with some of the infrastructure deficit by moving up a little more. And, you know, believe me, I as one of the people who is helping to deliver those freezes, I understand that there are people on the other end of those increases, but we're now reaching a point where the city is dipping into tens of millions of dollars worth of reserves, money that's tough to replace, to try and cover for costs that virtually everyone in this room, I think, would consider a core cost of city government. So we're getting to the point where the range of choices is diminishing. As far as sprawl, the reason I didn't answer that, Chris, is that, you know, what's funny is that the city, whenever it gets money on its hands for infrastructure, give or take, at least a third of it tends to go for new infrastructure rather than maintenance for roads and buses and everything else that's falling apart right now. Well, the irony is that the provincial government, when it gives the city money, tends to give the city money to build new things and have ribbon cuttings for new projects too, and same with the federal government. So I agree with you 100%. I just didn't feel the need to pick on the city in that respect, because I can tell you that when Vic Taves has got his hand on a check, or when Premier Selinger's got a hand on his check, or Premier Doer before him, they're just as much in love with new spending in suburbs and bigger and shinier highways as everybody else is. So it's a disease that's common to all levels of government.
Yeah, and the city is not immune to that. I mean, you're certainly right that they are encouraged. I mean, look at Waverly West. That was the province. You can blame Sam Cates on that all you like, but it really was. It was Gary Doer and Glamour. Yeah, I mean, like, that's when it was going to be an innovative, garden city of tomorrow. But that doesn't seem to be happening, judging from my last drive around there. But anyway, the city does have this attitude of, you know, like, suburbs pay for themselves. There was this, you know, this little strip of land along the perimeter deep in St. Vitale that they're developing into single-family houses. And it just, I can't remember who the councillor was that was talking about it, but it was like it was going to just, like, make money for them. Like, they were just going to make $1 million a year just from developing 100 houses. And it's like, well, if it's that easy, then you know, build a Winkler and we'll just, like, we'll fix everything. These things don't, you know, they don't pay for themselves. They don't help you pay for, you know, the 100-year-old water mains on Notre Dame Avenue. So I'd like to see them kind of get away from that kind of, like, you know, I'm not like build a green wall around Winnipeg or anything like that, but you just can't look at this as like some kind of economic panacea.
Okay. Moving on to I guess a point that the mayor made in his last State of the City speech, which had to do with political parties, and he was incredibly critical of the NDP in the sense that his belief is that they're infiltrating City Hall. So my question is I guess since 1989, the mayor alone appoints his executive policy committee, which acts as his cabinet. So given the fact that we have basically cabinet-style government on city council, does that facilitate the need for political parties, and are political parties possible in a city with 15 wards? We'll start with Christopher Leo on that point.
this is one of the more bizarre hypocrisies of municipal government everybody's got. Practically everyone in city politics has party connections, and if you know your way around even just a little bit, you know right away who's a liberal, who's a conservative, who's an NDP, who's NDP, and they get support from their parties when they're running for election, and so I mean, they do have parties. We have parties in local government. What we have is a situation that let me attack this a different way. I'm losing my thread here. Anyway, it's going to turn into a lecture if I go too far with this. from the voters' point of view, the big thing about parties is that it allows clearly to identify where candidates stand and to see what you're voting for. When you don't have a party system, then it's much more likely that what's going to happen is what does happen here at election time, that there are everyone gives out a kind of motherhood, what we used to call motherhood statements. I'm not quite sure what the correct term for that now is. In any case, just says things that are non-controversial and tries to stay away from the issues. If you have party politics, there's much more likely to be real debate about issues because you'll have everybody will have identifiable positions. And that should be encouraged. I think the NDP was right. I guess that's sort of connected to what you were asking. The NDP was right to, I was doing the right thing by running candidates under the NDP label. I think that's what we should be doing. The problem is that they seem to be the only ones that are interested in doing it. And the other problem is that it doesn't seem to give them any benefit at all. It probably cost them rather than helped them to do it. So we have very little positive incentives for good behavior.
I like to think I have an open mind, which is probably a bad idea in politics. And I say that because if you'd asked me this question 2 years ago, I would have been, you know, I would have been grudgingly saying no. And now I would grudgingly say yes. I think the more I look, the more room there is for political parties in civic politics and at City Hall with a condition. And I think this is why you had the backlash against the NDP so successfully there and so successfully fueled by the mayor in this last campaign. And that is that civic politics is different. You have different issues, just as federal politics is sometimes different. And to repeat that point, you know, you've got three people from very different perspectives at this table who could agree maybe on a larger civic vision but might disagree violently if we were talking about foreign affairs or something like that. And I think you need parties that foster that. And if you look at Vancouver and Montreal and their experiences, which have persuaded me to support grudgingly the idea of parties at City Hall, their parties are distinct. Obviously, there's ties between, say, the NPA, the Nonpartisan Association, the funniest name for a political party in Canada, I think. But the Nonpartisan Association in Vancouver is clearly a conservative party. It's clearly a pro-development party. But you have people from, all three federal parties have been active in the NDP and the NPA in the past. And likewise with CORE and Vision Vancouver, that there's some lines crossed there between liberals and social democrats and so forth. And likewise in Montreal. So provided the parties are clearly designed with a mandate to serve a civic interest, I think you get a very different response. And I'm very warm to that idea. Whatever the downsides, you'd have a lot of upsides in terms of having a clear mandate, not just for voters to vote for, but for councillors to work for and clear agendas. To be clear, as you know, a former insider or whatever, Chris is right. What we have right now is a party system at City Hall. It's just that we've got the worst of both worlds. We've got a party system that's pretending not to be a party system, so we don't get any of the benefits. The reason the mayor was upset that the NDP was trying to infiltrate City Hall was because we did it to the NDP in 2006, and you know, this might have reversed those results. Let's be clear. That was what was happening then, and you know, I was smirking when you know the reverse was coming back because what are you going to expect if you're going to start a party? You're going to face a party on the other end. One very quick point as well, just in terms of executive policy committee, the mayor's cabinet. That I think it's important to understand one of the reasons why parties would be useful is this: that the public image. Is that Mayor Cates is manipulating a number of different councillors on his executive policy committee, and so you have this, you know, sort of faceless Borg-like drone movement of councillors going and voting for everything that the mayor tells them to, and so, you know, whatever the mayor's agenda is leaping through council without much scrutiny. I think it's important for people to understand. Some of us are probably going to be going to the King's Head afterwards. You know, if we stay there till 1 or 2 a.m. and they throw us out. You can imagine what kind of a pub debate you're going to have there at that hour after a few pitchers of beer. Everybody's going to be pointing at each other. There's going to be one guy, maybe Ethan, at the end of the table, who's sitting there silently And he's worried about two things. How do I get out of here as quickly as possible? And he's worried about getting stuck with the tab, okay? The mayor's informal executive policy committee meetings, the mayor's cabinet, the real locus of decision-making at City Hall, is a lot like the scene I just described to you. That's how decisions are made at City Hall, and the guy at the end of the table is Mayor Cates. He's there, sitting there, watching everybody debate. He's the quietest one in the room. And the chaos that you may see on the outside that people don't attribute to that fact, the chaos is happening because you have what's really, I've always called it a six-mayor, or depending on which staffers are strong, a 12-mayor system. And the reason decisions aren't being made at City Hall is because you've got so many different points of view having those arguments behind the scenes, and they aren't resolving them. There isn't enough strong leadership to say, this is the direction we're going to go in. So you end up with strange compromises. You end up with strange proposals. And what to you as outsiders looks like the mayor pushing everybody forward on a strange but fast and fierce agenda looks on the inside like chaos. So be clear on that, that it's not, the cabinet system is not as simple and not as brutal as you might think it is.
Yeah, there's a lot more than just, you know, the core of power in the EPC. That was kind of the old thing. Like it was Glenn Murray's dictatorship, but now it's like, you know, Sam Cates tries to maintain that for himself. And but another thing that has happened is, you know, as Brian suggested, is we've seen a huge number of people that are just assistants or deputies that are just hired people that are you know, getting more and more power at City Hall. So that's, you know, that's another kind of head to the monster there. I would really, joining everyone else again, would love to see political parties be recognized and put on the ballot at election time. In 2006, during the civic election, I ran for council, mostly as a joke, but, well, I say that now. And, but
these are ways to get a laugh, I can tell you.
Yeah, well, it was a learning experience, too. But anyway, but I ran under the Winnipeg Green Party, which was like a, you know, kind of like a branch of the Green Party. But, you know, had their own little, you know, platform and things like that. And we kind of ran under that banner. There were six of us. And you know, part of it was to just make the point, like, you know, everyone else does this. We're just being honest about it. We're not pointing at the other guy and saying, no, you're trying to run us out. No, you and your party are trying to run us out. So I would just like to, you know, see it be put on the table. And that way you wouldn't have to play these dirty games and, you know, between the NDP in this last election and Sam Cates in, you know, in this one, and especially in 2006. So, I mean, Winnipeg had that up until, I don't know, 15 years ago or so. There was kind of two factions, you know, and they were like just tailor-made municipal parties. There was kind of the pro-business, Tory one, and then there was the Winnipeg into the 90s, which was like, you know, kind of like this loose coalition of liberals and socialists, so... But I think it'd be great to see that again.